Cool. Hi, I'm Veronica. I'm an addict. Hi. Somebody's got to do it, huh? Thank you so much, Lonnie. Sponsorship, huh? Okay. So I figured, I was thinking, you know, it's Friday. It's been a long week. Work, life, you know? So I'm just going to, like, take a minute, and I hope you'll join me. Taking a couple seconds to kind of breathe. Right? It's going to be a fun weekend, right? We got to kind of get into it here, right? Okay. So, thank you so much to the committee, to Dan, for putting my name in the ring for this. And, you know, it's always an honor and a privilege to share my experience. And being an addict is one of the greatest assets that I have. And so to, you know, use that as an asset is really just an honor. So I'm going to share with you all in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. A little bit about my experience and, you know, kind of my background in the, and where I'm at today. So my sobriety date. So a few things are really important to me and that have been constants in my recovery are my sobriety date. It's March 24th of 2007. And it's one day at a time, guys. My sponsor, Lonnie, she's, 10 years, so crazy. I haven't been sober for 10 years, so I don't want anybody to think, wait a second, I'm counting the days, we'll get to that. And my home group, so I've always had a home group, and my CA home group currently is the Journey of Recovery meeting. We meet on, so cute. Yeah. It's a pretty tame bunch. So we meet on Monday nights at the Eastside Alano Club at 7:15. We always have a meeting after the meeting, and we'd love to have you to our meeting there. So those are really important things, and so that's, you know, kind of my stats. So I'm from Chicago, so welcome to my Chicago friends. I'm so happy my Chicago, what was Carl saying at my entourage, my Chicago entourage is here. So I grew up in a small suburb right outside of Chicago. My parents, actually just this week, they celebrated 35 years of marriage, which is pretty incredible because they kind of don't get along a lot. So it's like kind of crazy, but you know, that's a message that they're sending, you know. So my parents are still married. I have four siblings. I'm the second oldest, and they all still live in Chicago. Thinking about this, I was like thinking about my, you know, what I'm going to talk about with my family and thinking about my siblings. I kind of like can get like choked up when I think about them because there's four of us and we're all kind of, you know, in the same age range and we grew up together and we've been through so much. And just through the amends process, I've been able to have these incredible relationships with my siblings. Like, they're my best friends, and I miss them like crazy. And I get to go home this weekend and see them, and I'm really pumped that. But, growing up with these siblings, you know, it wasn't always like it is today, you know? And I always had this, like, comparison thing. You know, I have a sister who's 2 years younger, so, you know, I could see that, like, I could always tell, like, what she's doing is like not what I'm doing, and I just don't get what she's, how does she know what to wear, how does she know what to say, how does she know how to take tests and do homework and talk to people and make friends, how does she know how to do that? And I just felt so lost, like just so lost. And I would always have that comparison when she always got better grades and was better in sports. And I was, even though I was older, I was like, you know, in her shadow. And she's taller than me too, so it's like, so I always had that. And I can remember my grandparents lived in Brookfield, Wisconsin. So even though I lived in Chicago, we came up to Brookfield about once a month, more in the summertime, and stayed with my grandparents for the weekend. And my grandpa was this like really big Greek guy who drank a lot and yelled a lot. And he would give us alcohol, like a little sip here and there. And we were kids, real little kids. And he would give us sips of alcohol. And my sister would take the little sips, get all giggly, play some video games, watch some TV, maybe go play outside, and then go to sleep. I would be up all night, like couldn't, tossing and turning, trying to go to sleep, getting up, trying to find. I found these, like, one night, these, like, expired Mystic wine coolers. Anyone remembers those? They were, like, fruit punch. And they were expired, so I, like, drank them and, like, immediately threw up, like, fruit punch looking. Ugh, it's, like, terrible. And I kind of recognized really early from that, those experiences, that, like, I react differently than my sister reacts when it comes to alcohol. Like, something's not right there. And at that, you know, young age, I thought, okay, I'm just, like, not gonna, like, if grandpa offers, I'm gonna, like, throw it in the sink or give it to someone, because I want to enjoy my time at my grandparents' house, and I know I can't do that if I set this thing in motion. So that was that first experience, and I kind of just, you know, trudge along through life, you know. And when I was a young teenager, I had my first, you know, real drunk. I went out on New Year's with my friends and just got smashed. And the last party we ended up at, the last house party in our town, I ended up at, my big brother was there, and I was already kind of, like, you know, feeling it. And he was furious. He got so, he couldn't believe it. He was mad at his friends who were giving me alcohol. And he, you know, kicked my butt all the way home. And he didn't tell my parents, which I thought was super cool. At the time I didn't, because he was so mad at me. And, you know, he was just furious. And I went to sleep. And the next day I was like, when can I do that again? Like, that's what I thought. When can that happen again? And that's kind of, you know, it all kicked off. Every time I had a chance to get out there, I got out there. You know, midway through high school, I started a job at a amusement park. It's, like, so crazy. An amusement park, and there were, you know, kids working there who weren't from my little small suburb, and they introduced me to pot. You know, we're going to smoke some weed. All right. I don't think I've ever been offered something and said, no, thank you. So whatever was on the table, I was game. So, you know, pot was the first thing on the table, and did that. And then from there, it just kept going. Everything that was offered, I took. And I, you know, drank, like, pretty alcoholically from the gate. And that's just kind of what my life looked like. I did go to college. I graduated. I don't know how. Actually, I don't even know if Lonnie will remember this, but in my first four step, I had this fear on my fear inventory that my college degree wasn't legit, because we work a program of rigorous honesty, and I remembered being in college, and I cheated all through college, like, just cheated, which now, even looking back, like, if any of you are in school, like, just doing the work, just, like, the program, really, just doing the work as it is in the book is, like, the easier, softer way. But I would, like, go to all these lengths to cheat in college. And so when I got to my fourth step and my fifth step, going through it with my sponsor, I was like, should I, like, go back to college and, like, tell them I'm sorry and I'll do it right this time? And she was like, no, let's not be too hasty here. No, you don't have to do that. You know, how about you, like, I don't know, take some little night classes, read up. There's this thing called the internet. Read up some, you know, come up to read those books that you have lying around, and, you know, kind of do it on your own, so you, you know, feel more, you know, secure in my knowledge of my field in the workplace. So, you know, I did that, and I've been there for 2 years, 8 years later, I have a real job using my degree. So that's kind of how it happened. So kind of toward the end of my using career, I kept having a couple of feelings. I kept feeling like, you know, when you're in that bitter morass of self-pity, and when the morning after that pain and, you know, the guilt and the remorse, and it's just, it's going to be different this time, you know, there are all those, like, with or without a solemn oath, you know, all that stuff, and the switching from this to that, taking a trip, not, you know, all that stuff it talks about in the book. Going through all of that, you know, it's like we go through, you know, a lot to get here. And I kept thinking, something's going to happen. Something big's going to happen. And I didn't know what it would be. I didn't know if I would, you know, finally off myself after the, you know, dozens times that I tried, finally, you know, put my car into the median on the freeway because I kept, you know, that would go through my head all the time, or get arrested, or I didn't know what was going to happen. I just kept feeling like that. And then I also would feel like I wish something or somebody or something would just like pluck me out of this hell and put me somewhere other than here. But I was like so stuck in that hell day after day, routine after routine, same thing, you know, on that ground. It's like ground. We just had Groundhog Day. I don't know if anybody pays attention. It was just Groundhog Day. I think over and over and over again, that cycle. But I didn't know how to stop it. And I couldn't. I didn't have the resources. And so kind of what happened was my parents called me the amazing disappearing daughter, and that's kind of what my using looked like. I would be like there 1 second and then gone in a flash, you know? And I would even do that to like my friends at the bar. They say I give the Irish goodbye. I just leave. I kind of do that now too, sorry. I love you all, but I was, you know, but I would come home. I would like disappear, but I'd come home around like Christmas, birthdays, you know, crying. It's going to be different. I'm so sorry. I can't believe I like, you know, my mom had gotten me this job at her big company she worked for, and I failed a drug test and then lied to her. And it's so embarrassing. I'm so sorry. I'm not going to do that anymore. They'd give me some money, you know, feed me some food and let me stay there. And then I'd be gone, you know, a couple days later. Once I sucked out of them what I was looking for, I'd be gone. And so throughout that coming in and out of my family's life, my mom had caught me in the basement using. So she caught me, and she was just, I think she was just shocked. I don't know. She knew it was bad, but I think that just really hit her like, yikes, like this is really bad. And I really didn't care because I was like, well, I don't know, I've been doing this thing a while, and I'm you know, sometimes I'm good. I feel like I'm, you know, I could tell you, I'm good, leave me alone. But I was dying inside. And so she caught me, and then there was like some consequences, and then I disappeared again for a month, and then I was back in the house around Christmas and New Year's, and my sister was helping me. You know, she really, you know, Becky did like, she really tried, you know, the people that love us, like, will literally die, you know, trying to help us. It's really incredible what they go through. And even now, you know, as a young, you know, sober person, parents come to me sometimes. And it's like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, kick them out, maybe. But parents, like, can't do that. You know, it's, like, just really crazy what our families go through. And we just use, you know. So it's just really incredible. Thank God for the amends process. So I was like trying to stay sober, and I went out for New Year's, and it's like, this New Year's, I'm sober. I'm going to do New Year's sober. And I went out with my sister, with some of her friends to a house or something. I'm sober. So then I like had some champagne because I was sober. New Year's, right? Had some champagne, and then that turned into a whole big mess. You know, I don't have to tell you what that looks like. Everybody knows what that kind of looks like. And my sister had to deal with that, and my brother. Yeah, it was a really ugly kind of situation. And the next day, you know, my sister's like, you know, you got to do something. You can't live like this. I'm like, yeah, I like 100% agree. Like, you could have put me on a polygraph test and I would have passed. I 100% agreed. Every time I would say this isn't going to happen again, I don't want to live this way, toward the end there, I meant it. I really did. But I didn't know how. And then once you put one in me, all bets are off. And so from there, she brought my parents kind of in this situation, and they said, okay, we'll take you somewhere. You know, so they kind of begrudgingly, they weren't sure. You know, my parents did the best they could. You know, they still do. They do the best they can. And, you know, for some reason, I'm like just like, you know, a selfish little brat sometimes, and I expect a lot out of them. I expect a lot out of people in general, and I really don't have a right to do that, you know? And so my mom takes me to this, like, counseling center thing for, like, an intake assessment, and it was crazy because that counseling center was a place that I, was like literally seconds from running my car through weeks before. It was like a block away from a bar that I would frequent because they had dollar pink pussy shots. And I would have like stacks of plastic shot glasses, you know, whipped cream all over. But just all that bar was like two blocks away from this counseling center. And there, a couple weeks before, I was driving, you know, drunk with my boyfriend or whatever. I had that flavor of the week. And my foot wanted to go on the gas in my car. I was steering it towards this building, and my foot wanted to go right through this building. And today I know that God stopped my foot, and I didn't go through that building. And a couple weeks later, I was sitting at a desk across from some dude asking me how much I used and how much I drank and did I want to kill myself. And guys, I was, for the first time in a long time, honest. I was honest with this guy, and I told him what had happened to me with that building 2 weeks before, which I don't know why they didn't just like commit me at that moment. But what they did was they sent me to treatment. But they said, you know, we have like a couple days from now until the bed's ready at this treatment center. And so those couple of days, and I don't know if anyone has had this experience too, that like, I don't know, I talk with the women I sponsor about it being a game of inches, like football, right? Super Bowl this weekend. It's a game of inches. And for me, you know, there's just like that little glimmer, and then it can just shut so quickly. And there was like, you know, I was in that treatment center, and, you know, he was telling me about this, and I was like, yeah, okay, I'll do this. I don't know. I guess I wanted something to pluck me and put me somewhere. Maybe this is it. I'm not sure. Maybe this, I don't know. I've heard of people going to rehab. Maybe I just, it's like part of like my life, you know, because it's what my life looks like. And, but then there was like those 2 days where it was like, maybe it was making like too big of a deal out of it. Maybe it's not so bad. How am I going to sleep without smoking weed? How is that going to be possible? 28 days? That's a long time. What if I miss some calls or something? Which is funny because I got out of treatment, I had like 3 missed calls. I think like one of them was my brother or something, because I hadn't talked to him for like a year before then, and he decided to call me once while I was in rehab. Yeah, so that was like a weird kind of, yeah, experience that I had. But I made it. I was, you know, stayed in my mom's house. She kind of locked me in there and fed me a bunch of scrambled eggs and tea. I don't know why my mom thinks like scrambled eggs and tea are like the cure-all, but that's what it is for her. And then they took me to this treatment center, and I went into treatment, and, you know, I stayed there over a month, and I learned a lot about the disease of addiction. I learned that I'm not a bad person. I'm a sick person. I met women who kind of looked like me, kind of felt like me, shared the same stories as I did, even like the war stories. Like, I'm going to share one kind of using story. I can, you know, one, I don't know if you guys have experienced this, but I would have times at bars where I would say things because I heard other people say them, like, I'm not an alcoholic. Alcoholics go to meetings. Ha, 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 right? It's, like, so funny. And, but then thinking, like, dang, I'm probably an alcoholic. And then this one night I was going to pick up from my dealer, and I'm in my work clothes. I got off of work late, and I go to my dealer's house, and I walk in there, and, you know, we sit. He gives me a little taste of the product, and, you know, we're kind of chatting or whatever, and I buy the bag, and he says, you know, we're kind of talking. He says, what are you going to do tonight? I said, go home. Like, I just got this bag. Where else would I go? And he's like, what's in this bag is not for going home. This is like for going out and having fun and sharing with people. And I was like, you must be out your mind, because I am not sharing this with anybody, haven't for a while. I'm like alone doing my thing by myself. That's what it looks like for me. A cave, a dark cave is what it looked like for me. And the dealer's like, that's not what this is supposed to look like. And that kind of planted a seed of like, yikes, you know, another reason why I'm like not like other people. So, you know, there were stories like that in treatment that girls could relate to me on. You know, these women had the same similar stories. I was like, wow, this is, you know, so I had that relatability, you know, which is something really important here. And the most important thing that happened while I was in treatment is that meetings of Cocaine Anonymous happened 5 nights a week. And these women brought these meetings. Some of them still do. Some of those women still do. I run into them from time to time, and they still bring meetings into that treatment center. And they told me about CA meetings, you know, when I got out and where they went. And I was convinced these women were getting paid, because why else? And it was January. So it's like, why would they come here on a Wednesday night in a snowstorm to talk about whatever they're talking about? Because I wasn't really paying attention. Like, I just was convinced, like, they were getting something out of it. They don't. If you don't do H&I work, you don't get paid for it, but you get paid in other ways, and it's really incredible. So they told me, so I got out, and I started going to meetings. Meetings. And I'm going to talk a lot about meetings right now, because that was what my life looked like when I first came into Cocaine Anonymous. Every night of the week, I went to meetings. The first meeting I went to was on a Monday night at in Chicago at the Recovery House, and this guy was chairing, and he said it was a really small meeting, and there was, I think, one woman there, and she did not say one word to me. But the guy who was chairing was like, "I'm so happy you're here. My girlfriend's going to be here on Friday. Please come back on Friday. Actually, come on Wednesday. We have a good one on Wednesday, but then definitely come on Friday because my girlfriend will be here, and she's awesome. And don't think that all meetings are like this meeting, because, like, this meeting's really small." And it's like, oh, okay, I don't know. All right, sure. So I, like, went to that Wednesday meeting, and there was a good crowd there, and then I made it to that Friday meeting. And I walked into this Friday meeting, and there was tons of people laughing and hugging and just having a great time. And I was like, whoa, this is crazy. And then this woman walks up to me, because he must have sent her my way or something. It's like, hey, I got a seat for you right here. Come on. My name's Lonnie. Sit right here. I'm so happy you're here. And I was like, I think I know her. I think I recognize her, but I don't know if I said something right away. I'm not exactly sure what the chain of events was. Maybe we were, like, at the break smoking, and, like, do I know you from somewhere? And it turns out we had, like, worked together at this random restaurant, like, a few years before, something like that. And I was terrible. I remember, like, oh, you were that crackhead that worked there. Because at the time I was just drinking, so at the time it was like, ugh. But then it was like, here we are, in a meeting of Cocaine Anonymous, and I'm dying. Can you help me? Yeah. So I just started going to a ton of meetings, and at one point, Lonnie had asked me outside of one of the meetings, "Why don't you have a sponsor?" And I knew what, you know, I'd been to rehab, kind of knew what, actually, when I had a friend who, like, a normal friend, Colleen, and I thought, Colleen's nice, maybe she can sponsor me. She's, like, not in the program. She's actually probably an alcoholic, but, like, still drinking. And, so she said, "Why don't you have a sponsor?" And I said, "Because you only have 10 months, Lonnie." And she just started crying. She's, "Oh my God, you want me to sponsor you?" And I'm like, "Yeah, but I thought, like, it's like a rule, you have to have a year or something." And she's like, "I don't think so. Let me ask Trish." "Let me ask Trish and see what she has to say." And Trish was the only sponsor at the time. So she went and asked, and then came back, and she said, "You know, I'm on step 9, and Trish said I can sponsor you, but, like, I can't let you catch up to me." So I got to finish some of my meds. We're going to get working. Yeah, so from there, you know, she kind of, like, gave me the suggestions, but really I zoned in on just going to meetings and, like, coffee, and that's what I did. I just going to meetings, going to coffee, going to meetings, going to coffee. Then on March 23rd, I went to a lot of meetings. I went to a lot. I didn't have a job or anything. I lived with my parents. They were really annoying. So I went to a noon meeting, you know, at the local Alano Club, and I went to four meetings that day, and the last one was with Lonnie. We went to a meeting together, that Friday night meeting, and I left, and I was just kind of feeling like just like something was missing, you know, like, I don't know, is this my life? I'm 22 years old. These people are so old. I mean, they're cool, and like, I'm probably in the right place, but I don't know, I just wasn't, I didn't have a solution. And I went home that night, and I had a bottle, you know, hidden somewhere, because clearly I had some reservations, and I drank. And I just drank. And right away, it was like a switch went off. Like, right away, almost like my head was like the Exorcist, you know, spinning around. It was like, okay, now how am I going to get more? Do I remember a dealer's number? Oh, my God, this is crazy. Maybe I don't want to do this. Am I crying? Am I happy? I don't know. I called Lonnie. I was like, I don't even remember what I said. I do remember her saying, call me when you're sober. And I called my sister, and it was just like this kind of crazy, like, I don't know. That's just what I did. And then so the next day, I woke up in the morning, and my parents kind of knew what had happened because I don't know, because my room was upstairs, and they could always know when I was drinking and home because all the pictures would be off the wall because I was just dunk, 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 you know, all the way up the stairs. So, you know, the lovely picture of my grandmother sitting at a piano was shattered in the dining room, so they knew there she is all lit up again. And so the next day, I, you know, called Lonnie again. What should I do? She said, go to a meeting. Let's meet later. And that's what I did. I went to a meeting the next day, and I met with Lonnie. And, you know, she said, okay, what happened? What's going to be different? Let's get down to this. And, you know, we had started kind of working the steps before then, and she said, okay, let's look at 1, 2, and 3. You know, let's look where you're at with those. And I said, I don't know. I mean, I felt like I did a good job. I read the 12 and 12 and kind of wrote what it says in there in my own words. Isn't that it? She's like, no, that's not it. That's not what working the steps is about. Working the steps is about being rigorously honest and getting down to causes and conditions and finding a power greater than yourself. And, you know, the list goes on and on. That's what it's about. And she said, you have to be honest with these steps or you're not going to recover. And if you're not honest with these steps, you're not going to hurt me. Because I'm just here, just one woman trying to help another woman stay sober. And you're going to be the same, you know, if you do that. So then we really got down to it. And I continue to go to meetings. And I'm here to tell you that meeting makers don't necessarily make it. You know, that's not what it's about for me. But I have found, my experience is that when I'm continuously going to meetings, when it's a part of my life, steps are a part of my life, prayer is a part of my life, staying current with a sponsor is a part of my life, sponsoring other women, reaching out to newcomers, all that stuff is there when I'm in these meetings and I'm connected. And I've had times in my sobriety where I've gotten away from meetings, and one by one, bit by bit, it goes away until we know what happens. We come to meetings, too, to find out what happens to people who don't come to meetings. Because they come back, oh, I did it again, you know, and we don't want to be there. I don't want to be there. So that kind of, you know, that experience really kind of was that inch that I needed, like that, you know, we really got to get down to this. This isn't just a, you know, fun club party time. This is about life or death here. So we started meeting once a week. That's what we did. We met once a week, and I went to a meeting every day. I did 90 and 90, and we read the book. And at the time, Lonnie, I don't know, you still do, right? I don't know. She might have just quit or something. I don't know. I'm going to put you on blast. But she was working as a bartender. She was working as a bartender before she got sober, and then continued to work as a bartender. So, I mean, there's a message there, you know. We can go anywhere as free people, and we can do anything. So she was working at a bartender, so I would go to her work, and she'd be on that side of the bar, and I'd be sitting on a stool on the other side of the bar, and we'd have the big book in the middle of us. And we'd read the big book, and she would read it to me, and I would ask questions or zone out. Some of this stuff is just so dry in there. So we would read the big book, and I started working the steps. And we worked through the steps as it's laid out in the book, as Trish did with her. And she would, you know, she had 10 months sober. Let me remind you, she had 10 months sober when she started sponsoring me. And a lot of times she would say two things. One, she would say, "Let me ask Trish," which was a message that I still use today. When I'm not sure, I'm not here to make it up. This is not the Veronica program of Cocaine Anonymous. Let me find out for you is important. And it, for me, it has some humility in it, which I need truckloads of humility. Back it up, because I need it all. And the other thing she would always say is, "How about you pray about it?" She would say, "Pray about it." I would go on and on and on. My mom's killing me. I can't find a job. This, you know, all of our issues that we have, our little silly little plans and designs, it says in the big book. I would go on, and her response would be, "Well, how about you pray about it, and then maybe we can talk about it tomorrow." I'd be like, was she not listening here? Was she not listening? And so she said later that sometimes she would just say that because she wasn't quite sure what to say. Yeah, it was her first sponsee. But it really didn't matter, because that is my answer for everything. And that really has always worked for me. And, you know, this is my recovery. These are my steps. She's not my therapist or my relationship counselor or my mom or my friend. She's not that. She's my sponsor. She's here to guide me through the 12 steps, to help me find a power greater than myself that can restore me to sanity so I can have a spiritual solution and carry that on. That's what she's there for. So pray about it. Yeah, that's always an answer for me. She also gave me a suggestion to find a job in the program, find a little job, find a service commitment. And, you know, that was something I was always, I guess, like, cautiously optimistic about, maybe. I don't know, I was happy that I would have somewhere to be. I'm, like, kind of socially awkward, and, like, I just don't quite get it, you know? I don't quite get life. I don't life well. And okay, she said, you know, show up at 7:30, you know, half an hour before this meeting on Friday night, and shake everyone's hand who walks in the door. You're the greeter. And I was like, that's not a commitment, Lonnie. Nobody's ever greeted me before I've walked into this meeting. I've been coming here for a few months. And she said, well, it's high time someone started greeting, so that's going to be you. And that was my first service commitment. And I showed up, and I dressed nice. She told me, dress nice, and, you know, shake everyone's hand who walked to the door. I even had a little sober buddy, this another guy, or like a friend of Lonnie's sponsee, who was, she was like, he saw what Lonnie had me do, and he was like, yeah, you know what, Dan needs to be doing that too. Dan, you show up. So we were kind of like little greeter buddies for that meeting. And it was so important. And I was able to meet all the people who came in. I was able to, you know, kind of create this little, like, sober friendship with this other dude who's, you know, same, like, new, trying to kind of figure it out and find a spot here. And I have not looked back as far as service work since then. I've always carried a service commitment. And it has been, you know, just an incredible part of my recovery. So another little experience with that whole greeter thing. So this guy, Dan, who was like my little greeter buddy, he was my sober buddy. I don't know what we called it. We had this like little term, like find your little sober buddy. I think it was sober buddy. So like, Dan's going to be my sober buddy. You know, he didn't like creep me out. You know, he was like, he was just like really a nice, genuine guy. And we, you know, we'd give each other rides to the meeting and then go out for coffee with everyone after. And you know, we had this like really great friendship kind of starting. And then one week he didn't show up. You know, he didn't show up to that meeting for that greeter commitment. And, you know, where is he? Let's call him. And then there were people at that meeting that were like, well, he's out again. There he is, out again. And I hadn't experienced out again with anybody at that point. And I was like, what? That's crazy. We got to go find him. We got to bring him back in. I don't know why. I thought like everybody got there and stayed clean. I thought that was the thing. Later, I found out that actually we're the miracles. That's not the thing for us. What he had done was the thing that we do, is that we use, you know. I'm powerless. I've lost the choice in the matter once I put one in me. And, you know, he was gone. And Lonnie and I were working the steps at that time. I was on in and around steps 2 and 3 and was thinking about this whole God thing and not really sure, kind of. I just wasn't sure, like, where I stood with that. You know, it talks about in Bill's story, he says, you know, that he took what was convenient and not so difficult and then kind of left the rest. And that's kind of what I did. You know, growing up, we went to church. I don't know. I guess there's something out there, but, like, I'm too lazy to, like, look into it. And, like, then I was too busy getting high. So I just wasn't sure. And I also felt like, you know, I was always kind of a mistake in this world. God kind of screwed up because I don't fit in and I don't get life. And how could I be worthy of any grace or any happiness? I thought I was kind of doomed, like that was my life. And Lonnie, you know, sat so patiently with me every week and read through this book and said, you know, you don't have, you know, I said, Lonnie, but you, in Bill's story, you know, Bill's story is like the bomb. I just love his story. And he talks about when Abby comes to see him for the first time, you know, after Abby got sober, that Abby had a starry-eyed look. And there's this picture of Lonnie that comes in my head when that phrase is read or said, is, you know, that starry-eyed look. And she had that. You know, she was going around with a car. Well, first she was on the bus. Then she was on a car that was literally duct taped, you know, working as a bartender, you know, little apartment. You know, it wasn't so, you know, fancy, no, not grand. But she had that starry-eyed look. She had that glow about her that I'm sure some of you have seen. Maybe you have even had that, you know. And I said, like, well, Lonnie, just tell me about your God, you know, and that's what I'll do. Because at that point, my buddy, my sober buddy, that I was like, this group is my God. This group is my higher power. This guy is my buddy. That can carry me. He was back at it again, you know. He was out there again. No human power. And she said, you don't even need mine. You don't even need the group. You don't need a doorknob. You don't need a chair. Just your own little conception. All you have to have is the willingness to believe that there's something out there that can help you. And you've made a beginning. And from there, I launched into a course of vigorous action. That's what it says. You know, we get into the fourth step. And I started putting stuff on paper. And she, you know, took me through it as it's laid out in the big book. Even with all my, I would always like try, like I said earlier, with like cheating in college, with my steps, I feel like I've maybe not tried it all because I've like found the answer, I found a solution, but I would try all these different ways. Like, what if I type it? What if I just like, do I really have to bracket fear after every one? Like, what if I just copy and paste and like type it? Or like, what if I just, do I have to write it? Because she would say, no, you have to write it. Do I have to write it? Like, can't I just tell you, like, just repeat what I said? She said, no, that's what it is. This is what Trish has done with me. And this is, you know, this is not a program we take piecemeal. It's an all or nothing deal here. It's a life or death errand. And so finally, begrudgingly, you know, like just after really balking at it, I finished my fourth step. And since then, I've done several fourth steps since then. And now the rule is, okay, time for a fourth step. Let's plan a fifth step 2 weeks from today. It's like, yikes. And sometimes even the night before, I'm like, you know, finishing it up. you know, yeah, she doesn't co-sign my BS, which I love and appreciate and hate all at the same time. Yeah, so we set a time for a fifth step, and she sat down with me, and I read through my fourth step. And if any of you have heard someone's fourth step, sat through someone's fifth step, it is a complete honor and really a privilege that someone would trust me with their, you know, every nook, dark nook and cranny of their lives. And but it is like really boring. So thank you for listening to my fifth step, because it can like really go on and on, especially the first one. Yeah. But she heard it all, and she shared some stuff that had happened to her. She didn't, you know, laugh. She didn't gasp. You know, she sat there patiently and listened, and then shared her experience with me and let me get that all out. And after that, she, you know, left and let me take that hour to, you know, go back through, you know, the first five proposals, as it says in the big book, and, you know, and then get into six and seven. And we did six and seven, and that was a really, you know, at the time, I don't know how effective it was, which maybe I'll talk a little bit more about that later, but it really was an incredible experience, because we were able, she had switched sponsors at that time, and we were able to do six and seven kind of in a different way with some women that were, that really have had like a profound, like, yeah, impact on our lives. So, yeah, and then we got into eight and nine, and so we went through eight and nine. Eight, you know, we took from my fourth step, and we wrote it all down, and she had me write these letters. So she had me write these letters for my amends, and she said, you know, it's not like we're going to necessarily read these letters to these people, but let's get our thoughts down on paper. Let's get ourselves, let's get you centered. Let's get all the, you know, get yourself out of it. Put out what somebody had done to you and put your part on paper so you can go to these amends prepared. And you can go, like the book says, with tact and with respect and with, you know, like the thought of the other person. You know, I'm not there to cut someone. I'm not there to make them feel bad. I'm not there to shock and awe them with what I had done to them. And then go out and set those appointments. And that was really hard for me at the beginning. You know, it's like really hard for me to admit that I'm wrong. It's like the worst. It's like so hard for me. But she said, just make the appointment. Just make the appointment. And at this point, I'm a woman of my word. Most of the time, I'm starting to gain some dignity. And so if I make these appointments, I'm most likely going to show up. So that's what I did. I started making these appointments. I started setting out to set these rights wrong, to take responsibility and make these amends. And, you know, I read it in the book. We read it together. But until it really clicked for me, you know, until the steps really click for me, I feel them, you know. And I feel this connection growing and something I'm tapping into, like, okay, this is happening. And I'm starting to, like, my shoulders are going back a little bit, you know. And I'm like, I don't need a greeter commitment to say hello to someone. And that started happening in the ninth step. I have a job that I show up to regularly and do my best. Not like do my best like before when I was using, I would say, they don't even know how great I am and how, like, they should be so happy that I work here because I am the best employee, as I'm like downing beers in the bathroom. But really showing up to my job and you know, being a good employee. So, yeah, so I did those nine-step amends, and then we, you know, carried on with the rest of the steps, and then into the 12 steps, she said, get out there and find a sponsee. She said, oh, you can't find a sponsee? All right, let's go to Women's Treatment Center. We're going to find you a sponsee. And, you know, and then I've always, you know, since then put myself out there, you know, for women who are looking for sponsors. And I take them through the steps, and I guide them just the way that Lonnie has done for me. And, you know, and that really has been a bright spot of my life. And, you know, that's what keeps me here, you know, is giving it away. It's like you got to give it away to keep it. And that really is true for me. So that was kind of my experience with the steps. At some point, I don't know where I was at in the steps, really. Probably balking on my fourth step, I met the guy. And the guy said, I haven't had a sponsor for 6 months, and I feel great. And I said, I'm going to have him. And so 6 years later, that ended in divorce and brought me to Milwaukee, which is something really exciting. You know, that's what brought me here to Wisconsin. I wanted to get away. I was ending a marriage, and I had a friend in the program who lived up here, and I gave her a call. I didn't have to say much because you guys know how we show up for each other. I didn't have to say much. She said, come on up here. I'll set the couch for you. And I came up here, and you know, it was a difficult time. You know, it was a really difficult time. I was leaving. I wasn't really telling many people at the time. I think I told my mom, and that was it. Like, my dad didn't know for a couple months, and you know, it was back and forth, and divorce is not pretty. And but I came up here to Milwaukee, and I, you know, so let me back up just for a second. I went to, like, maybe a year or 2 years before I came up to Milwaukee, I had stopped going to CA meetings. And it's kind of funny now, but at the time, to me, it was not funny. But they changed how it works. They used to read how it works in meetings, and now they read, we were chosen, right? We are chosen. We can recover. I'm sorry. Excuse me. I guess maybe I still have a little something hanging in there. So there was this whole thing where CA is changing how it works so we can recover. And I did not like that. And I was, you know, whatever. I don't feel that way now. But at the time, I was like, you know, whatever, like a few years sober and on fire with service work. And I was just like, you know, this is not right. You know, we're not doing this. I'm not coming to CA anymore. And that's that. And Lonnie, who, if any of you know her, she is like CA's biggest cheerleader. She like wears this huge medallion CA, the hat. She's got like a jeweled cape that says Cocaine Anonymous on the, you know, she loves CA. And so her sponsee came to her, I don't agree with this how it works thing. I'm not coming to CA anymore. And her, with all, you know, now looking back, she must have had so much faith at that time and just love and you know, just, you know, really humility. And she said, okay, that's all right. I wish you'd still come. A lot of newcomers come, you know, but, you know, you got to do what you got to do. And, you know, then that's, so I started, you know, only going to these other meetings and did that for a while. So, you know, fast forward, now I'm in Milwaukee and I had been living here for about a year and my meeting life was getting a little bit stale. And a few friends had told me about this Monday night meeting, and randomly one night I said, let me check it out. So, you know, this is like now 5 years later, I walked into a meeting of CA, and I thought, if nothing else, Monday nights, as some of you know, is my call time with Lonnie, and I thought, if nothing else, my call time could be like, guess what I just did, you know? So I went to this meeting, and you know, everyone was so nice. I don't have to tell you guys what it looks like. You know, everyone was so nice, so welcoming, really happy to meet me, and, you know, it was a great meeting, and we went out to eat after, and then I got to make that call to Lonnie and tell her, guess where I just came from? And her response was, you know, I always knew someday you'd go back to those meetings, you know? And I said, why didn't you, like, harp on me for that? Or, like, keep, like you did with my fourth step. You kept, like, do the fourth step, do the fourth step, do the fourth step. And she said, because that's not my place. I knew you'd come back, you know? And if anyone knows Lonnie and the cape and the medallion, you know, that takes a lot of humility, you know, to not, you know, we're not here, no lectures to be endured, no axes to grind. That's what sponsorship's about. It's not go here, do this, sit here. That's not what it's about. It's my recovery. And yeah, so now I've been going to CA. I had this little GSR commitment, which just ended, and that was super fun. And you know, I got to meet a lot of really great people. And yeah, so that's kind of, you know, I still go to that meeting. Just this past week, I missed the meeting. I have this new commitment taking a meeting into a jail facility. And I just went this last Monday, and a little story I told the woman in there that I'd share with you guys, because I told them after, I'm like, you guys are so great. I'm speaking this Friday. I'm really nervous. And, you know, it just brings it back. You know, that's one alcoholic. You know, it was like four of us sitting around a table getting hyped up about recovery. And this girl shared that she had never felt so free in her life as she does right now. And she's wearing, you know, jail jumpsuit, sitting in a facility, not leaving for who knows how long. And she said she has never felt more free as she felt that day. And I just thought, that's incredible. And that's what we get through working the steps. This woman is working the steps through a couple of girls locked up with her because they have some books. And it's coming true for her. Job, no job, wife, no wife. We can all recover. You know, it can all happen. And we can, you know, work through these steps, and the obsession can be lifted. That no choice thing, I have a choice, you know? And I have this power that's not my friend Dan, you know, who's been sober for 7 years, might I add, which is incredible. I have this power that can help me. And I have the prayer that, you know, Lonnie sent me to, you know, and continues to. And I have that, you know, to get through rough times. And I'm not locked up, you know. I have physical freedom. And I can get wrapped up in my head, you know. I can go to jail up here and really get locked up there and not be of maximum use to people. But I have a solution that I can come back to, and that will work for me. And I'm so grateful that I found that here. And I'm going to end with a short reading from A Vision for You. It says, yes, there is a substitute, and it's vastly more than that. It is a fellowship in Cocaine Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we find the fellowship, and so will you. Thank you.